Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
I'm May Lily Lee. Welcome to Virginia Conversations. Thanks for joining us. Today, a visit with two cultural icons with Virginia ties. One who was born here, then moved to New York City. The other, born in the Big Apple, then moved to Virginia. The former from the small coal mining town of Big Stone Gap. Best-selling author, Adriana Trigiani. But we begin with the latter, a native of New York City, world-renowned artist P. Buckley Moss moved to the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia in 1964. Her artwork can be seen in more than 200 galleries worldwide, not to mention countless homes in America. Thus, she has earned the nickname the People's Artist. P. Buckley Moss, welcome to Virginia Conversations. How are you?
Oh, I am very, very good, very healthy.
As you traverse the state, where are you now?
I am now on the Chesapeake Bay. I'm down in Matthews, Virginia, and I just flew in from Florida, and I will be in Waynesboro before you know it.
Do you find that with another home in Florida, you have to get away from Virginia a little bit because of the celebrity factor?
It's not so much getting away from Virginia. It's just getting away and being with, how will I say, normal people. I mean, people who don't, you know, who just treat you like another human being, and that's very nice, because you travel and you kind of become someone you're really not. You're just another person, and it's so nice to be treated like another person.
We should point out to our listeners too that Matthews is the location of P. Buckley Moss Galleries.
Well, it's really our distribution center. So we're down here, and we ship out of here, and all our people who work at the distribution, shipping things in and out and keeping our books, they're here. Then we have the museum in Waynesboro, Virginia, where we have record keepers, and we have sales place, and we have, you know, shows there, and we open it up to the public. It's free, and we invite everybody to come.
And also in Waynesboro is the P. Buckley Moss Foundation, and I hope that shortly we'll have a chance to talk about that as well.
But first, that's very important.
Absolutely. I want to start off with a quote that I read from a colleague who said, quote, "Pat is painting all the time," end quote. There is a myth that artists don't have to work that hard, but you have a work ethic that dispels that notion.
Well, I think everyone has to have a work ethic. I have a grandson going to the Ringling School in Sarasota, and he has the same work ethic. You cannot get done in this world what you want to get done unless you are going to work at it. You want to be successful at something. You want to see your work be the best it can be, and that's what you're always looking for. You're always looking for, oh, can I do that better? Can I do this better? Can this be better? You know, and you really have to work at it all the time. I've been working steadily. I almost work like 3 hours off and 3 hours on. So I don't sleep. I sleep at 7 and get up around midnight, and then I just work all night.
Have you shown any signs of slowing down?
No, I'm afraid I haven't. I am getting older, of course, and that's kind of a bummer. But, you do the best you can with the energy that you have, and you just want more energy. You want to see better, you want to hear better, and you want to have more energy to work and do all the things you want to do. If you don't do the things that you want to do and that are creative and wonderful for you, they never get done. Something else will be done, but that particular thought or that particular movement won't be done, whether it be music or writing or whatever you do in this world. The questions that you should ask, if you don't ask them, they won't be asked. You'll ask other questions, but not that particular question.
I think of something that you were quoted as saying in Art Gallery International. I think of myself as a painter preacher. I make people feel good. I almost feel responsible to find joy for myself and thus for other people. So you really do find joy in painting. It's not just
work. Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes, yes. That's a statement that is very important to me. I like people to feel good around me. I like to touch people. I don't like people to be feel like they're less than somebody else. I think we're all We're all important in some way or another. And we all have goals and we all have joys in our life and sadness. But, you know, touching people is so important. There are so many people in this world who never are touched. And, you know, people will say, oh, you're a Pollyanna. Well, you're not a Pollyanna. You just like people to feel good. And you like to reward them with smiles when they've said something nice or do something nice for you. People are so kind to me, really, mostly. Some people aren't so kind. I shouldn't say everybody's kind.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. You've overcome pressure from the modern art culture. How do you feel about art critics? Do you take them seriously? Do you ignore them? Is it something in between?
You know, art critics have a job. And everyone has a job. You have to do the job the way you see fit to do it and the way you understand it. You can't expect everyone to understand your work or appreciate your work any more than you can understand or appreciate if someone doesn't like the way you sing. Or if I love watching Dancing with the Stars because I love movement. I loved skiing. I loved swimming. I loved windsurfing when I could do that. I love to watch dancing. I just feel like I'm dancing with them. Of course, I'm not, but I wouldn't mind at all being young again and dancing like that.
When Charles Corralt called you the people's artist, did that move you along in yet another trajectory, or was that just another feather?
You know, I think it was a recognition that you are there. You're not trying to make it difficult for people to understand. You're not saying that you're a super sophisticated and you don't have to like my work. You're saying you're welcome, and you're welcome into my life, and this is who I am. I am the paintings that I do. My paintings are hopefully going to make you feel good the way I want to make you feel good and the way I want you to make me feel good. I love it when people smile. My kids are so important to me, and when we get together, we laugh a lot, and we kid each other a lot, and it's a good feeling. I'm looking forward to Christmas. We're all going to have Christmas at my barn house. Oh, I shouldn't be saying that. But anyway, you know, it's just getting together. It's just fun. Just driving in the car is fun. We all sing, and some have better voices. My children always used to say to me in church, Mom, don't sing, because I don't have the greatest voice. But I love to sing, and I love to move, so it's really great.
Your imagery is so recognizable, and it's set in the Shenandoah Valley. Of course, so much of it is premised upon the Amish and the Mennonite communities. And you have actually said, I like the lowest common denominator, I like simple, and the Amish and the Mennonite are about simplicity.
Yes, it is so, and I like the lowest common denominator, and by that I mean I like everything to be simple. I like it not to be a complicated thing. I like people to look and understand. They might think my things are realistic. They're not realistic. They're very well-designed pieces to me. I think everything I do has a basis of design, I think, or contemporary work. I start with a contemporary painting and I develop into something recognizable. And I think that that's something that a lot of people don't absorb or understand or try to understand. But that they please and that you're happy with them and that they make you feel good, that's important.
That brings us to that four-letter word, folk. F-O-L-K. I know that you eschew that label. This is not folk art.
No, it's not folk art, but I don't mind you calling it folk art, because folk art, in folk art, people, the artist does not understand that they are a designer or that their work is so well designed or whatever. They understand that they love to paint, and I love to paint. It just so happens that I'm a trained artist. I went to the Cooper Union in New York, and it's a prestigious school, and it's a free school. And to have gone there, to me, is quite an honor. And when I say that I love the way my grandson works, it is because the school is very much like my school was. We didn't have a ball team. We didn't have a school song. We didn't have the colors. We didn't have anything like that. We were workers. We were all workers, and we were learning a work ethic. And I'm very grateful for the work ethic that I've learned. I'm very for the one work ethic that I live. I'm really, I thank my school, I thank my Lord, I thank everybody around me, because I have had a very good life.
I do recall how you characterized your work as a realistic form of stylized impressions. You know, these figures are elongated. I think of Modigliani. They're just so pleasing to the eye.
My favorite man in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so Modigliani is an influence. What are some other painters who have influenced you?
You know what? I don't want to hang Picasso in my house, but I love his work ethic.
Well, he was a misogynist.
No. I like anyone who loves to work and produces things from their own heart, from their own body, and from their own mind. And, you know, people say flattery, copying is flattery. It's not. It's stealing their thoughts. They shouldn't be copying anyone. They should be giving what they have to offer. And what they have to offer is not copying someone else's work. It's giving of yourself and putting yourself out there to be laughed at, to be criticized, but giving it from your heart.
I heard you like Michelangelo's David.
Oh, I love David.
How come?
He's one gorgeous guy. He is absolutely beautiful. Beautiful legs, beautiful butt. His head is absolutely marvelous. I have a home in Italy. It's only an hour from Florence, so we go see David every once in a while.
So how do you approach your pieces? Are you working from a photograph or memory? Are you sketching first?
You know what? I have taken photographs of progressions of my work, because I send them into the portfolio and tell them what I'm working on. So I have things from the base, and you can see how I work from all these progressions of a painting. And I think it's fun. And I haven't erased them from my iPad, because I want to print them out. I think it's important that people who talk about your work or look at your work understand how something is built. And I'm not the greatest speaker in the world, so I like to view with my eyes and not my words, but I like the progressions. I like to see how something comes about, and I know other people do too. And I will print them all up one time.
Okay.
And we'll have them in our archives.
Just as a preview, though, of that, do you sketch something out first, or are you literally just taking your brush to the canvas right off the bat?
Oh, I'm right off the bat.
Wow, okay.
I'm right off the bat, and sometimes it's not so good. Sometimes it's... You know, sometimes you, you go over it and over it and over it. But to be able to just, I've just shrink-wrapped two paintings, and I love my work. This is awful. But they're beautiful. I love them both. And one is just a valley barn, an early valley barn, and the other is an early valley house, which are symbols that I use all the time. But they're so peaceful and so relaxing to look at, but uplifting, and you want to go into them. You want to go into those paintings. So I'm shrink-wrapping them, and I'm going to bring them up to the barn and have everybody up there see them and the museum. So, you know, my life, as I said before, I can do whatever I want and enjoy it so much. And I enjoy seeing my dealers be successful with the work that I do for them. And I enjoy seeing, public television being successful with it. I enjoy seeing everybody being successful. I like them. I like them to say, wow, she did it for me, and it's good.
Yes, in Virginia, you've offered up your artwork as auction material for fundraising for public broadcasting, which is fantastic.
Yeah, they've made quite a bit of money with it. It's really, really exciting.
I'd like to take a little trip down memory lane, because you hail from New York, and there's quite a story there. As a child, you were called dumb.
Yes.
Stupid.
I was called
inattentive.
Stupid and dumb and retarded.
And you even held the record for the most number of visits to the principal's office.
Right.
And you were dealing with dyslexia, and nobody knew it.
No, and it was recognized at that time. I think it was 1933, the year I was born in, that dyslexia was first recognized. But it wasn't out there. You know, still, I was out in Iowa a few years ago, and I was having lunch with the director of the school and the president of the school. And I said, do you teach special classes to your teachers? It was a teaching college. And I said, do you teach special classes about kids with learning differences and how to teach them? And he said, no, we don't. I said, oh, my God, but you should be, you know, because these kids have such a tough time, and they have so much to offer you. A child with a learning difference is not stupid or dumb or retarded. They just learn differently. And they're the creative ones. If you let these kids, if you let them go, if you let them learn in their way that they can learn, if you help them along that way, they'll give you such great gifts. They're the ones that will give you the gifts in life. Think of the people in history who have had dyslexia. Thomas Edison, Cher, you know, all these people. I love Cher's voice. What would we do without her beautiful voice, you know?
Well, that does bring to mind what your studio must sound like. What are you playing when you're painting?
Well, I've been playing music lately because I don't have any books on tape. But usually I listen to books on tape, and I completely live in them. I can go all night with a book on tape and work the whole night, and I'll be so relaxed and it'll be so wonderful, and I've had a great experience. I'm a multitasker. I can listen and work. And
like a good piece of fiction, or?
I listen to everything.
Okay.
Everything.
I want to go back to that period that was so significant to you. You were a girl who was facing these different challenges. Who at the time was your biggest supporter?
My biggest supporter was always my mother and my grandfather. My grandfather knew I wasn't stupid, and my mother knew I wasn't stupid. So she found a very special school for me in high school in New York City where she went to school. My mother was an Italian immigrant. Her mother died in the Triangle Fire in New York, and she was just a little kid who she was the youngest of 10 at the time. She just found her way. She was a very intelligent lady. She read a lot. She was really fun. She was a doll. Anyone who knows her or met her knows that she was always ready to have fun. She was great for my kids. She taught my kids a lot. I mean, you know, she'd be angry with them, and one of them would say something to her, and they'd all laugh. So it was great.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire is a story I've never forgotten. It's always haunted me.
Yeah. It's horrible. And it just happened again just happened somewhere where they locked them in. All these people burned to death.
The experience that you had with learning disability has now been parlayed into a foundation, the P. Buckley Moss Foundation. I want you to share with us what the mission is.
Well, the foundation is for children's education, and we're having fundraisers all the time for them, all kinds of fundraisers. I paint on cloth with cloth paint, and a quilter will take that big square that I do, and they will do a hanging piece or a quilt around it, and we'll auction that off. Some of them have brought up to $4,500, so it's very, very nice. And what we do with the money is we offer scholarships to children with learning differences who want to go on to college and aren't about to win scholarships. They have to write in, and every year we give scholarships. The other thing we do is we give scholarships to people who will teach children with learning differences, people who want to go into that field. And so every year we offer money to both of those things. I think last year, because of the cuts from the government cuts, we offered funds for teachers because they really needed them for supplies and things. Teaching kids is so much less expensive than keeping them in jail later on. It's so wonderful to give a child the chance to have respect for themselves and to feel good about themselves and to build their self-esteem. That is so important in this world. And teaching and having good students and learning is just something that we must not cut in our life and in our government. My life is dedicated to seeing all my grandchildren go through college, a college that they will work well in.
A lot of our listeners want to know what brought P. Buckley Moss to Virginia. You're a New Yorker. And it was in 1964 that you and your then husband, Jack Moss, and your five children moved to the Shenandoah Valley. And that wasn't enough. You had yet one more child, making it six.
Well, I had to have one in Virginia. He's my Virginia boy. He's a joy. He's in New York now. Well, what brought us to Waynesboro was DuPont. We were very happy to be here. I love the country. We had been in Port Arthur, Texas, and Texaco and Port Arthur, Texas was a wonderful company, but the people were not my kind of people. They hated too much. They hated blacks. They hated Jews. They hated Catholics. They hated everybody. And I know I was playing bridge with my husband's boss one night, and he was saying how black people were part of the animal race, not the human race. I said, oh, my God, you've got a doctorate? Where did you go to school? What were they teaching? You know, so we were fired about two weeks later.
You had a whole family to take care of. You you're managing this life, and yet you still made time for your painting, which was still in full force by the time you came to Shenandoah Valley. By the time 1967 came up, you were doing a one-person exhibition. How did you find time?
I worked at night a lot. I always worked at night, whenever it was peaceful. And most of my kids had started to go to school, and they were gone to school in the morning. And I would take a nap, and then I'd work and pick them up at school. That's the way life went. You do what you can do when you can do it, and however you can do it, and you don't complain about it. You don't complain about the time you don't have. What you do is you make use of the time you do have. You don't complain about the money you don't have. You use what you have and live with it. This world that we're living in now, everyone feels entitled to everything, and it's crazy. You don't need everything.
Someone remarked that a painting that you did, a self-portrait called Madonna, of you and Christopher, that particular portrait done in 1966, you look tired in it. I would imagine
tired. When you paint all night and you have six kids, it's pretty tiring. I mean, just think of the wash. When I think of that laundry room, I want to close my eyes.
You might have become instead a lint artist. You could have flourished in dryer lint art.
Oh, God, yeah. I could have. That would have been, I liked everything sharp. That would have been too fuzzy.
Mel, the story is told that it was your second marriage that really helped as well in along the lines of marketing and a partnership that really helped boost that business end.
Well, I told you that dyslexic people are not stupid. They just learn in a different way. And my father was on the New York Stock Exchange, and I always wanted to understand that. That wasn't for me, and he wasn't about to teach me. But you still have the practicality. You have that practical, strong work ethic, and that is something I've always had and I've always appreciated having. And I think you're constantly thinking of a better way to do things, and you're learning. So, as I said, because you're learning different doesn't mean you're stupid.
Now, this man was Malcolm Henderson. I know you're not married to him anymore, but his son Jake runs your P. Buckley Moss Galleries now.
Yes, he runs a part of it. He's a terrific guy, and he's been with me since he got out of Oxford University.
Now, is it your daughter Patty who heads up the P. Buckley Moss Foundation?
Yes, Patty heads up the foundation, and she will probably turn it over this year to somebody else. But she's a very conscientious person, and she's a real good girl. She also runs our distribution part of the center.
What role have your children played in your art, if any, besides, say, the business angle that we just touched on?
I don't know. Well, Patty's the only one who's really involved. Chris is involved now and then. He talks to Jake regularly, and he's my baby boy, and he's probably, God, I don't even know how old he is. He's probably about 40-some-odd years old. I don't know. But I know how old the oldest one is.
Well, you've got six. It's hard. The numbers get fuzzy.
Well, I've never worried about it. I hardly know their phone numbers. So what you need to know, you know. What you don't need to know, you look up.
It's true. I came across recently a Mary Oliver quote, and I really wanted to get your take on this. She said, the most regretful people on earth are those who felt the call to creative work, who felt their own creative power restive and uprising, and gave it neither power nor time.
Oh, time is the thing. The things you give up, you don't even think about giving them. You don't even think of them as things you've given up. But you look back on them and you think, oh, people are going to think I gave that up or that I didn't care about that birthday. I don't care about my own birthday. I don't care about anyone's birthday. When I want to celebrate with you, I'll celebrate with you. I call the kids and say happy birthday, but I don't see them for their birthday. And we get together for Christmas and Thanksgiving and Easter, that kind of thing. And everyone likes to get together. They all like one another. The children all love one another. And I don't invite them to come home because I have to work, and I don't want them in the house, to be honest with you. I don't have a big enough house for all of them. So what I have done, and this is the last time I'm going to do it, but I take them all on cruises. I took them around the Mediterranean and to Sicily year before last. So this next year, I'm taking them to Greece and Turkey and Croatia. And that's a gift to them, and it's a gift to them as a learning gift. It's a gift that you have to see the other part of the world and another part of the world. And you have to see the way other people live and how other people live and how people, you know, I have a house in Italy, and what you get along with in Italy is so much less than here. You don't have a million pair of shoes. You don't have tons of clothes. You don't have waste. you buy your vegetables every day and your meat that you have, and, you know, you eat sparingly, but you spend a lot of time at the table and talking to one another, and we don't do that here. We move too fast, and everyone has too much to do. I love Italy, and I love my children to be there, and I like to be together with them, but not in my small houses, because I don't. I want to work when I'm home.
In our last minute, you can clarify this for us. I know you've talked about places to visit, but what about living? Do you like living in a smaller town? Is Charlottesville, for instance, too big a town for you?
No, I don't want to live in Charlottesville. I like Charlottesville, and I've seen it grow. I mean, it used to be a much smaller town.
Are you more of a rural dweller, or do you...
You know, I love living here, and I love living in Waynesboro, and I love living in Florida, but I arrange it so nobody comes to my door. Nobody rings the bell.
Why is that?
Because I've unhooked the bell.
Are you inundated? Is that why?
No, because I unhooked the bell, so nobody comes.
Yes, but why do you unhook the bell?
Because I don't want the bell to ring, and I don't want it to interfere with my work.
Okay.
So I always tell people, don't come, I'm working, but if you're coming and you want to visit me, you know, from another part of the country or something, I said, I'll tell them to call me before. And I also tell them that I have a guest room, and they're welcome to come. If the guest room's empty, they can have it. It's downstairs, and I'm upstairs for the most part. I come down to the kitchen, and that's about it.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. And if you don't mind just playing along, I want to end on a rather obscure note, but folks who are big fans of your work will really want to know the story behind your geese. Why are the geese footless?
Well, two reasons. One, they look more like ballerinas to me, and I think of them that way with their bulky bodies and their narrow little legs. But the main reason is that in the Bible, feet are a sign of pride. So you've got two answers there. So you can choose the one you like best.
I love them both. P. Buckley Moss, and people who want to find out more can go to pbuckleymoss.com and learn about the galleries, learn about the museum, and about the foundation, as well as the artist herself. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very, very much for calling. We'll see you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder, past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. We'll be back with best-selling author and Virginia native, Adriana Trigiani.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. From Big Stone Gap to the Big Apple, best-selling author Adriana Trigiani has struck literary gold, mining her small-town roots. Her novels have been translated and sold in more than 35 countries. And if you think you might be strangers to her work, think again. Among her credits, she was once a writer and producer for the TV hits The Cosby Show and A Different World. Adriana Trigiani, welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm sure your name is mangled often.
Well, you know May Lilly with an interesting name. it tends to get flipped or, you know, and I grew up in Big Stone Gap, and I was always called Adrian. Adrian.
And
Adriana
is,
became Adrian.
And there is a story to your name, a family story.
Yes, there's a family story. In the Italian tradition, you name the first two children after, depending upon the sex, after the father's father, the mother's father, or the father's mother, or the mother's mother, okay? So my sisters were named after my grandmothers, and then I was kind of a free spot, and if I was going to be a boy, I would have been named Anthony after my father, or Michael Anthony after my grandfather, which is what ended up happening with my brothers. Anyway, in the A names, my father kind of flipped for Adriana, and half of his family was from Foggia on the Adriatic, and he loved the sound of it. There was a little bit of a discussion about two N's or one. I ended up with one N, which I'm so happy for because it's very linear. Trajani has one N in it also. So my dad named me and then promptly called me Audra for Audra on the Big Valley. And, of course,
the Linda Evans show.
I have nothing in common with the great Linda Evans in coloring or portraiture, but he always called me Audra.
That's great. You have said that your father and your mother were early influences on your writing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about them.
Well, you know, I think parents are, I'm very aware of this. I have a 10-year-old daughter, so I watch how she watches us. You know, we always say we're watching her, or any mother will say, or father, you know, I'm watching those kids like a hawk, you know, I'm always watching them. But what we don't think about too much is how closely they're examining us and what we do and say and how we carry ourselves in the world. And my parents, the first thing I have to say about them, of the many things, is that they were both educated. And for children of immigrants, this was a really big deal. My father graduated from Notre Dame and my mother from St. Catharines in Minnesota. You know, these are immigrant schools, I always like to say, the red checkered tablecloth schools. And they met, actually, at Notre Dame. My mother was a librarian there. So our lives were really always about everybody's going to college and you're going to make something of yourself, and education is the key to unlock every door. And now that I'm grown and my father's gone and my mother's getting older, I look at it and I see what a tremendous, tremendous goal that they pulled off, what a dream they had, and all seven of us are college graduates. And any parent will tell you that's a big, big dream and none of it's guaranteed. But I look at that knowing, you know, all the struggles of financially and in terms of business and work, and they managed to educate seven children, and that's really a big deal.
Your father was a garment manufacturer and your mother a librarian.
Yes. My mother didn't work after she got married, meaning in a library, but she did work with my dad. My father was really had a missionary mentality, and that's how we ended up in Southwest Virginia. There was a thing in the late 60s called the War on Poverty, and the War on Poverty program was kind of government agency, Small Business Administration, would give very, very low interest loans to businessmen to come south to put up businesses. And in Southwest Virginia, and indeed all through the Appalachians, the idea was to bring factories in. And my father had been trained by his own parents to be a garment manufacturer, and they were very aggressive in coming after my dad. And he said, you've got to come to Virginia, or North Carolina, or Kentucky, or West Virginia. We need it. Because the idea was they were going to use the model of northeastern Pennsylvania, where the women worked when the kids were in school. So you dropped your kids off at school, so you started at 7:30 and you were done at 3, and then you picked up your kids and you went home. And this was very effective in Rosetta, Pennsylvania, Martins Creek, Pennsylvania, where my father was from. So they were going to pull the model and do it in the South. Well, my dad put up a factory, and then that factory started to do well, and so he put up three more in the communities in the most need in the mountains. He was very devoted to the cause of that, and he had a lot of support. Linwood Holton was elected governor. He was from Big Stone Gap, and he actually put my father on the Commission for the Status of Women. He made my father the chairman of that. You know, we had really a great life in Big Stone Gap, so much so my mother doesn't want to leave, so we all make that trek into the mountains on a regular basis to be with her. But he really had an ideology about what he was doing. You know, he really believed in it, and he did not get rich or famous from it, but made a living enough to educate his kids, and we're all still here.
I think that says a lot. About your work, let's start with Big Stone Gap. That was your breakout novel, but it really began as a screenplay.
Yeah.
It started really in a different form altogether. Then someone intervened.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Mae Lilly, life is very interesting because an artist should try to remain unencumbered from whatever things tie them down. I mean, the minute you start doing a formula or you think you've got it licked, is dangerous. And I was working in television, and I was trained by the greats, Bill Persky, who created That Girl and Kate and Allie, Bill Cosby. I was fortunate also to work for him. He's one of my heroes. I think, you know, I got my PhD in comedy from him. Then I went on to work for just incredible people like Dolly Parton and Lily Tomlin, and I could keep going, you know. And television was changing in the 1990s. I got my first job in 1988, and I was young, out of college, and, you know, a playwright. I came here to be a playwright, and I soon saw I had had all these staged readings and productions in regional theaters, and I could not make a living. And there was no way anybody was going to support me. There was no Pope for this Michelangelo, if you know what I mean. Of course, I'm being facetious there. I'm no way Michelangelo. But there wasn't anybody stepping up with a check. You know what I mean? So I had to work, and I had all these great jobs. And I call them great jobs because I'm never at a loss at a cocktail party to tell people what it was like when I was selling tickets in a movie theater or I was a temp on Wall Street. Anyway, I had to come up with a way to make a living, and two of my girlfriends, and we call it graduating with your class. When I moved to New York, I moved into a boarding house because, of course, I didn't know anyone. And I had some distant cousins who owned a restaurant in Midtown called the Vesuvio, and they were fantastic. And they really helped me. But then eventually, you know, you have to, you know, I stayed with them for a couple of weeks, and then I went, I got to get a room somewhere. And I put together a comedy group, and one of the girls, Eleanor Jones, who's actually from Virginia, I cast her in the comedy group, and she said, you need to live in our boarding house. And I went down to the Village, and there was this double brownstone, and every girl got her own room, and I was, oh, my God, please let me in here. Some of the happiest memories of my life were in that boarding house. I just loved it. Made friends, and those friends in the mid-1980s are still in my close circle of friends. Two of them, one became a producer, Ruth Pomerantz, and the other became a book agent. Now, books don't figure into my life until 1998. Up until then, I had a television agent at the same agency, who's still my agent, Nancy Josephson. And I'm just telling you these names because I love for everyone to know who they are.
Sure.
So Nancy Josephson figured out, you know, how to get me work in television, and this was a miracle because I was being paid to be a writer. And they read all those plays that, you know, over the course of, you know, that had made no money, and they went, she can write. Let's put her on the show. So I started out on A Different World. I did The Cosby Show. I did a show called Working It Out, where Alan Zweibel was the showrunner. I built up all these experiences till I got to The Cosby Show. Bill Persky had also hired me in the interim. I was writing pilots for everybody. I was the busiest bee in the world, and I was about to run a show called City Kids for Jim Henson Productions. So everything in that world was going great. I was burning the candle at both ends. I got married in the midst of that. And then I felt the ground shifting, and I went, TV is changing. And I was just saying this morning to a friend of mine. I said, you know, you kind of have to know your voice where it fits in the times. Now, my voice is getting popular again, but I write warm. Warm, cozy, emotional, hopefully hilarious takes on family life and love and romance and work. Love and work, the dignity of the working person. So that fit in the television shows I was writing, and then suddenly it took a turn, and this reality stuff started happening, and writers were less in demand, and I thought, what am I going to do? And I had made a documentary film using my grandfather. My grandfather, Trigiani, had shot films in Rosetta, Pennsylvania from 1935 to 1962, so I had a treasure trove of stuff that had been, you know, in my grandmother's basement, and we restored it at DuArt Labs and with all these old Italian and Jewish men who knew how to do it. And I made that movie, and it won an award, and the man came up to me, who had produced Sling Blade, the movie, and he said, what's your next project? And I just blurted Big Stone Gap. He said, well, what's that? And I said, well, I have a story in mind. So I wrote it first as a screenplay, and then set it up there, and in the interim, my friend Suzanne Gluck said to me, you know, this is a novel. You know, I love the characters, but it should really be a novel. So I wrote the novel. But I was also working in television, so I would get up at like 3 o'clock in the morning and work on the novel. But, of course, I didn't have a child then. And as everyone out there with a child knows, that all changed then. You know.
Aren't these flexing different muscles? When you write something for TV or screen, it's about omission. When you write a book, it's about inclusion.
That's a good way to put it. Or, that's a perfect way to put it, or you could say when you are writing a screenplay, a play, or a television script, you're dramatizing. And when you're writing a book, you're describing it. So one is active, and the other one is describing the whole entirety of it. And they're very different. I'm so different. And really takes different parts of yourself. But that's why I love doing the movie scripts, and I love directing, and I love doing that, because it's they're all different muscles. All different.
I don't want to dwell too much on the upcoming movie, but where are we? Is it going to be? I know you fought hard to have it shot in Virginia.
Well, we are going in 2013. We are seconds away from starting it, pre-production. We've figured out. I found the most incredible financiers who are willing to film it in its entirety in Big Stone Gap.
Great.
And it's taken me 12 years. I mean,
would you say that's what's tied up things, is your insistence that it
be
shot in Virginia?
Oh, yeah, that's totally what's tied it up. I mean, if we were going to make it anywhere else in the world, we would have done it already, you know, four times. And a couple, well, there was one instance where it kind of got switched at the last minute, and I said, well, I don't think so. But also, you're climbing we're doing an independent film, and, you know, you're climbing a very big mountain here. Because you can go to the Cineplex and see what the studios make. They don't make this kind of movie. So what we're going to do is make an incredibly beautiful movie using the greatest talent that is attracted to the material. And we're going to put it out there and see what happens.
I found this description of Big Stone Gap, and I just love it. It's 1978, and Ave Maria Mulligan is the 35-year-old self-proclaimed spinster of Big Stone Gap, a sleepy hamlet in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. She's also the local pharmacist, the co-captain of the rescue squad, and the director of The Trail of the Lonesome Pine, the town's longest-running outdoor drama. Ave Maria is content with her life of doing errands and negotiating small details until she discovers a skeleton in her family's formerly tidy closet. Love that. Can you clarify something for me, too, around the trilogy of Big Stone Gap?
Sure.
I'm seeing that it's a fourlogy.
There's a fourlogy. There's four books.
Okay,
and there will be another.
Oh, wonderful.
The readers really want to know what happens to the characters, and frankly, so do I.
So I know you've been asked this a million times, but at least this question comes from Virginia. What was it like for you growing up in Big Stone Gap?
Oh, it was fantastic. Well, first of all, it was an adventure. I came from a place, you know, 6 years old, and 6 years old is really great because you can really remember stuff. And I did not want to move down to Virginia because I had a really great life with a school with nuns in black habits, with white wimples, the Salesian nuns, and the people had names like me, all these Italian names, Stampone, Goffredo, Castellucci. I mean, it all sounded like mine. Very safe feeling with grandparents nearby, aunts, uncles, cousins. It was really safe and really a delicious feeling of belonging and no sense of otherness. And then we moved to Big Stone Gap, and I'm 6 years old, and I'm in the second grade. And I walk into the classroom, and first of all, the kids aren't wearing uniforms. They're wearing regular clothing. And there's a huge swath of different personalities immediately. And the teacher, Thelma Carter, was in a pencil skirt and a little blouse, and she was beautiful. And she wrote on the blackboard, which I was used to, but she checked things on tests, and everything was different. And mostly what was really, really different was the accent. I couldn't understand what people were saying. So that's the first thing. But, you know, we were exotics. And my mother did this crazy thing where she dressed us all alike to go to school, which is like, now when I look back on it, it's so humiliating. I mean, we looked cute, but come on. And, you know, immediately you knew you were in different waters, but it was also really fascinating. And my father bought the oldest house in town, literally the first house built in Big Stone Gap, I think. And the windows were shot out, and the ladies that owned it lived around the corner, and they'd made it very neat, and they were Mrs. Miller and Mrs. Tinsley, and the neighbors were pretty fantastic, and we had a yard, and this old shed that had the name Betsy on a piece of tin, that was the horse. That'll tell you how old the house was. They say that 1893 the house was built. So we, you know, the Goodloe family had owned the house, and it was kind of their summer home. They would come in the summer and stay there, and there were all these old antiques in it, and it was a Victorian, huge, big old house. And then it got very interesting because we found out that the Goodloes had 7 children, 5 girls and 2 boys. So, and we used the bedrooms in the same configuration that they did. How crazy is that?
Another of your works that came out very recently, Don't Sing at the Table,
yeah.
Life Lessons from My Grandmother. Could you please share a lesson or two from your grandmother?
Yes. My grandmother Lucia used to say, and this applies to any career, nobody has to see how many times you rip out the hem. So your goal should be to make something perfect, and nobody has to see how many times you try. No one ever sees how many times I rewrite a sentence. And that's just the way it is.
Wise woman.
Very wise one. And then my grandmother Viola, oh my gosh, there's so many great ones that she imparted. But one of my favorites was about men. She used to say, yeah, they'll promise you the moon and you'll wind up in the gutter. I always loved that one.
I read an interesting fact about you. Mm. You don't blog.
No, because you know what? May Lily, that's writing. And I'm doing 8-9 hours a day. I just can't do it. Now, what I do is I answer every email and every query on Facebook. That's me. And I bundle those. So when I get a minute and I answer everything. Yeah.
That's
but I am not that good. I marvel at the writers that can blog. I think it's fantastic, and I enjoy reading them, but I could never do it.
I want to talk about the writing process. P. Buckley Moss, wonderful artist, shares this program.
Oh, our homes are filled with P. Buckley Moss.
Oh, she's going to be delighted to hear that.
She's sharing
this program with
her.
You.
Oh, we love her and our family. Oh, yeah.
Well, it's really clear in talking with her that painting itself, just the act of painting, is a joy. However, as far as writing goes, I've seen a random quote. I remember someone saying, I don't love writing. I love having written. So what about that process for you?
That's not true for me. I mean, because it's so weird. Because first of all, you're in this place, this of the subconscious and the imagination. And I really love making the art. It's the same with a play or a movie. I love doing the work. When I'm done, I'm really done. I kind of don't look at it again. Isn't that weird? But I don't. When I'm touring, there'll be times I pick up the book and I'll read a passage that really meant a lot to me, and I'll go, oh, I miss these characters. I miss them. I don't want to leave them, and then, you know, I move on. But, is that answering your question? Of course it's arduous. It's very hard to do it. It's not easy. But as you keep doing it, hopefully you get a little bit better at some things. But every time I think I've figured something out, it's dispelled. It almost disappears like bubbles in the air. I go, oh, now I got to start over and figure this out.
P. Buckley Moss paints at night. I know you don't write at night.
No, I don't. I really sleep. I mean, I'm a sleeper. And
does that
God
mean
my
you're,
daughter is.
Are you an early riser and get cracked
I'm
into
a
your...
very early riser. I mean, a good night for me is when I'm in bed at 8 and I get up at about 3, put on the coffee, and I'm by myself for a few hours before my daughter and husband get up. And that's a really good work day for me, a good kickoff. And now that I have a family, I really work around them. When she's home, I'm with her, you know.
You know, you mentioned Dolly Parton. She does the same thing. She gets
Dolly is the queen of everything forever. Dolly has a new book out. I hope everybody gets it. It's called Dream More. Now, I said this morning to her editor, Jake Morrissey, at Riverhead at Penguin Press. I said, Jake, I have yet to meet the first person in the universe that doesn't love Dolly Parton. She's beloved, and when I worked for her, I learned so much. She is the most warm, open person, but she doesn't suffer fools. She might be, and I say this having worked for these brilliant people, the smartest person I've ever met. She's really smart. And yet, she's also a great artist. She's very free as an artist. Her book program, her dream program with the kids, she's provided so many libraries with books. There's no level that Dolly Parton isn't to be honored. She's amazing as a woman, as a writer, as an artist, as a businesswoman. She's amazing. And working for her, you know, like I say these things, you know, I got to work for Dolly Parton. I mean, it's amazing to me.
Maybe that early rising is the key to your successes, both of you. You know, a lot of people don't realize how many songs. She's written over 3,000 songs.
Oh, I know. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, but we're here to talk about you. And I want to
talk about our Dolly.
We could. But
you know something?
Yeah.
I'm going to say my growing up in Big Stone Gap got me the job on that show.
Oh.
Because I went in and I said, I have two words for you, Dolly. And she looked at me, she said, what are they? And I said, Kaz Walker. And she started laughing because she used to be on the Kaz Walker Talent Hour. Kaz Walker was a grocer in Southwest Virginia and East Tennessee. He used to get on TV and call people out for writing him a bad check. I mean, it was fantastic, and she was on that show. Anyway.
Your 10-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Was she an impetus in your writing a young adult novel, Viola in Real Life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, it's going to be so uncool for my kid to pick up a book I've written that I know that I'll be dead and she'll read Big Stone Gap. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because kids are not into that. My daughter doesn't want to hear me sing, and she doesn't want to read my books, okay?
So sad.
Anyway, I was reading a lot of young adult fiction, and I was approached by Tara Wycombe, who's my editor at Harper Teen, and she said, would you think about doing this? And I said, well, you know, I write real. And as you know, right now, vampires and werewolves and dystopia are all the rage. And I really don't write that, although I would love to, but I don't have a talent for it. And I said, well, if I could write like Beverly Cleary, if I could do, you know, 15 by Beverly Cleary or The Luckiest Girl, I don't know if you read those growing up, but I read those. They were written in the 50s, but I read them in the 70s, and they were just as current to me as they were, you know, 20 years earlier. But I said, if I could do realism, I'll do it. And then we came up with this idea, and I said, I'd love to do a young filmmaker because everybody's got a camera now. So that's what we did.
Yeah, you mentioned the novels for teens, and, of course, the big breakout novels include the Twilight series, and a lot of parents they're wonderful, and then some are concerned if an 11 or 12-year-old starts watching, reading, or whatever. But I always explain, that's about vampire teen sex, not human teen sex.
Exactly, and it's also, you know, who didn't watch Frankenstein?
That's right.
That guy was in makeup. I mean, I think that, that's a little much.
So,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, we watched the computer wore tennis shoes. Well, there wasn't a computer that was a human, but we believed it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So. Now, food. Mm-hmm. It shows up a lot in your work. How about in your life?
Oh, yeah, I love to cook. I'm a big cook. I love to have parties. I like to have people over. I like to impress my husband.
What's your favorite kind of pasta?
Well, I've got a few, but if I had to winnow it down, in the summer, I love to make pasta with peas and mint. Peas and mint and fresh Parmesan cheese and little cracked pepper. Oh, fantastic. And if I was going to be on death row, I'd have to have a fresh marinara sauce with basil. That's what I make a lot. I love that. And my family does too, thank goodness.
Now, I think there are some folks who are not only hungry right now,
mm-hmm.
but they're curious about what you read. What does the writer read?
Well, you know, my husband and I, just this morning, you know, we have this discussion. It's an ongoing thing in our marriage. Where are we going to put these books? And I come in the house always with armloads. I just was in La Jolla, California, and there's a secondhand bookshop, and I picked up probably 15, they were shipped, oh my gosh, 15 biographies. I'm a big biography reader. So I have one of Teddy Roosevelt. I know this is going to sound nuts, but I like life stories.
Sure.
Anything real that's a life story. And right now I'm reading Deary, which is the biography of Julia Child, the chef. And that was just a little, I'm tying up a little segue there since you asked me.
Absolutely, thank you. I actually loved My Life in France, her autobiography.
Another great one. I have it and read it and loved it.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Adriana Trigiani, thank you so much for joining us today. The official website is adrianatrigiani.com. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you. And my love for a beautiful and glorious holiday season to all my Virginia neighbors. We love you very much, and I'm very proud to have grown up in this great state of Virginia.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our guests, artist P. Buckley Moss and author Adriana Trigiani. And thanks, of course, to you for listening. We'll be back with another edition of Virginia Conversations next Friday morning at 9. Until then, I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great day.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.